Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is January 21st, 2021, and I'm here with Dick and Mary Bishop in Fairbanks, recording by Zoom, and we're also joined by Tom Paragai, and thank you everybody for joining in and your patience while I figure out how to record it. So this is a follow-up to two previous interviews that we did in November and December 2020. And so I want to just keep going a little bit. And so, Dick, what would you like to start with?
Maybe just a short reference to some past discussions regarding when the federal subsistence priority is in operation. And I kind of did a quick look at ANCSA and ILCA and the federal regulation booklet, and I don't find any reference to the priority only being in place when in times of resource shortage. So I just would like to make sure that that's something that perhaps needs further digging around, but It's not a cut and dried situation, apparently.
Yeah, we did talk a lot at our previous interviews about the subsistence issue and the subsistence priority and the legislation and all your involvement with that. And it is a very complicated subject.
It sure is. Yep. I guess beyond that, if you want to start, I know we've got ADF and my involvement in ADF and G and AOC and and wolf control.
Yeah.
Good grief, when I got into wolf control, I thought I'd never get out. Talk about complicated. But why don't we start with ADF and G? That kind of spans the whole business, if that's all right.
Yeah, and we'll just say that you were interviewed previously by Kathy Harms and Scott Brainerd about your work with Fish and Game and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and some of your years there and some of your stories. So I know that was a while ago, and we may repeat things, and that's okay. But just to start, you worked for Department of Fish and Game starting in what year?
Well, as it turns out, the first job I took with Fish and Game was a very short one and very early, but it was very significant, and that was as a temporary at Gamble, Alaska, keeping track of the walrus harvest.
Oh, right.
In the spring of 1962. So that was just 6 or 8 months after we had arrived in Alaska, and I'd never seen an ocean before. Much less a walrus. And so it was really an experience. It was one that I really treasure. Anyway, so that only lasted a couple of months, I guess, while the walrus harvest was going on. And after that, I went back to school at UAF and sort of muddled through a master's program there. I did get interested in marine mammals, and because of that adventure in Gamble, so I'd hoped to work on marine mammals for a master's, which I did, on harbor seals. And after that was done, then in 1965, I was employed as a temporary at Fish and Game in Fairbanks. And the reason for being temporary was that my boss said, "Let me know when you've completed your degree requirements, including your thesis, and we'll talk about maybe a permanent position." He was very shrewd. He knew what the deal was. Anyway, so in 1965 then, I did start on a regular basis with Fish and Game as a temporary again, which was fine. I really needed the work. And I was kind of one of the grunts, I guess you could say. So we did a lot of processing of specimens in the lab, which included processing parts of wolves that were brought in by wolf hunters who came in to claim the body. And of course, we did quite a few specimens from moose as well, because we were collecting moose jaws. That was in the days before better techniques for aging moose, and contacting hunters in the field. I also began to learn about counting moose from the air, how to distinguish them, how to keep track of where it was, and that sort of thing, which later, as time went on, that became a fairly important thing. Well, in 1967, I finally finished all my degree requirements and applied for a permanent job, and got one, and pretty much continued with a lot of what I was doing, but I wound up doing a lot of moose aerial survey work, and okay, Mary just left me a note about what I may be repeating, and I don't know if I am or not, from previous Zoom meeting. Anyway, so I wound up doing a lot of moose aerial survey work, both in the interior and some in South Central during ensuing years, and processing a lot of specimens in the lab as well. And another major task was calf tagging on the Tamara Flats in spring from, I think we started in 68, I'm not sure. Anyway, 69, 70, maybe 71. The idea was to get visual recognition means to find out where the moose that calved on the Tanana Flats moved at other times of the year. In 1969...
Excuse me, can I bring in a nice little...
Yes. Bit?
Richard's toes were always very sore when he was... when he was tagging calves, because they jumped out of helicopters and then ran around chasing the baby moose. They could only be a few days old, or they couldn't catch them. And so they had one guy who was often John Burns with the rifle protecting Richard from Mama Moose as he was
or vice versa.
Or vice versa. But I really remember the very black sore toes.
From jumping out of the helicopter?
No, actually, it wasn't from jumping out of the helicopter. All he did is get cold and wet from doing that. But chasing the moose through tussocks and other stuff on the terrain was very rough going. And so your feet were always getting banged up. And I finally found the perfect footgear for it was the Vietnam era army combat jungle boots, because they were stiff enough to protect my feet, and they had pretty good traction, and the water drained out of them once you got back out of the swamp.
I was thinking steel-toed boots for the landing.
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad. The landing wasn't bad. It was usually just wet and cold. But so I continued helping with that for a couple, three more years. In 1969, the department had reorganized their structure, and area biologist positions became available in 68 and 69. I applied for one in McGrath. I really had a strong interest in getting into the rural area again. I guess Gamble was certainly rural, but that was pretty short. So I was lucky enough to get the position and spent almost 3 years in McGrath before moving back to Fairbanks. And that too is a really interesting and unique opportunity, because I did get acquainted with a lot of people: McGrath, Nikolai, Tawida, Lakeman, Schumana, Sleep Mute, and
Takatna.
Takatna, and technically Bethel and that whole area was also part of it, but it was just really hard to reach that far, although it on rare occasions did and had the opportunity to work with one of the, one of the most esteemed wildlife biologists that I ever ran into, who was working in Alaska at the time, and that was Cal Linsink. And he is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and was a refuge manager down there and did a lot of waterfowl work. And I was fortunate enough to get out with him a little bit. So I got to some of the tundra villages with him and the tundra. He made a great comment. He had learned to fly so that he could get around as he wanted to and needed to, but he occasionally had to take the plane in for maintenance in Anchorage. And we were flying around over the delta of the Yukon and Kuskokwim, and ponds as far as the eye can see. And I said, "Cal, how in the world do you keep track of where you are out here?" He said, "Well, I've gotten to know the country, and it really isn't bad, but really, what really confuses me is when I have to go through the mountains to get to Anchorage and take this plane." And, you know, it's really amazing how adaptable people can be, and how something that they're not accustomed to can really confuse them. So anyway, we spent almost 3 years in McGrath, and it was a good experience. One of the principal things of importance there was simply making good contacts with the local people, because what I found out, sort of belatedly, I guess you could say, was that almost very consistently, the local people still had a hangover from pretty strict federal enforcement of hunting and trapping rules. And there was an old set of file cards in the Fish and Game Office that were left there when the feds moved out, and it was turned over to the state. It had been a federal building, and that's where my part of the office was. I shared it with the protection officer. His file card was of violations in that general area. So I got to looking through it, and by then I learned enough names of people that I knew who was who when I found the names. And it was really quite remarkable that almost everybody and every man in Nikolai, for example, not quite, but a considerable majority had been arrested for taking cow moose out of season or other violations. And under the federal rules, it was pretty serious matter, because they could wind up going to jail for 60 days. As much as 60 days, and the jail was in Fairbanks. So it was very difficult for people under those circumstances, leaving home for that long, especially probably in the winter or that general time of year. But so I really learned a lot. I got to know a lot of really good people, and that's when I developed an acquaintance with Lake Minchumina and people there when we went and sealed beaver, which was part of the job, sealing beaver pelts that had been harvested by people. We did that up and down the Kuskokwim and over into the Yukon as well. So it was another chance to get around a bit. But a major part, because of that background, pretty strict enforcement of rules by the federal agents who had preceded me and the one guy that was there before me, people were pretty reserved and guarded in and how what they communicated and how they communicated. So it took a while to get through that. One of the good things that came out of that was working with a VISTA volunteer, Terry Dickey, who later went to the museum here in Fairbanks for many years. And he was in Nicolet when I got to McGrath. And there were several people, several men in McGrath who were interested in getting into guiding hunters as a means of financial gain. So we worked on that jointly and got the information together, and we had sessions with, it turns out there was three guys, I think maybe I did mention this before, and got them through the testing and so on for guiding, and they succeeded in getting their license. Out of the three, I think only one actively guided, the other two may have continued to do some assistant guiding, which all of them had done. But I think only one actually got out on his own to do that.
Yeah, you had mentioned that before in a previous interview. I'm interested about how the local people responded to a fish and game biologist being there. And you said they were reticent because of previous experience. Do you think you helped change that by your relationships with people?
Well, I think so. I think times were changing anyway, but it took a long time to get over that. You know, there are lots of memories. For example, there was a tragic incident in McGrath where a fellow committed suicide, and at the time I was there, and also there was a law enforcement guy there, a protection officer, former state trooper, and people came running over to my house and to his house and said, we want the commissioner to come over. There's been an apparent suicide. Well, there was no commissioner around. That was something from much earlier, when in territorial days there were government commissioners that were kind of the local judge and jury, actually. And but still, you know, people remembered that. And in a tight spot, you know, that was the name that came to the surface. I didn't get called biologist often. There's one lady who liked to call me an anthropologist. She knew perfectly well the difference. And she knew I knew the difference. She just liked to tease me about it.
So that's interesting anyway, that there was a protection officer stationed there with you.
Yes.
And who was that?
Yeah. Pardon me?
Do you remember their name?
Jack Allen.
So did you and he go issue citations and violations like under the federal system?
No, it's a short answer. We used a much more relaxed approach. Preventive maintenance or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, more emphasis on just showing up and being around and people knowing that was a possibility and the availability. So I don't think Jack really liked to issue violations, and I didn't either. I didn't have that many occasions all life. I did have one occasion that was prime. I was asleep and went out with Nixie Mellick, who was a local charter operator and fur buyer. And I spent a few days with a couple of beaver trappers from Sleep Mute up in the Olitna River. So Nixie took it upon himself to just take me out there and dump me off. There was no way to tell the two guys that were there, that I was coming. So he explained to him I was some fishing game, and there was a lot of talk and yupik that ensued that I, of course, didn't understand. And finally convinced them that they weren't going to get arrested and it would probably be okay and I'd only be there a couple of days. But they were pretty nervous, and it turns out they had just killed a cow moose, and they hadn't even had time to butcher it by the time we landed. So they were really on edge about that. And it's the same thing, you know, like in McGrath, those records, people knew darn well that there's a, in the past, people got busted for that. Well, I didn't bust them. I spent a couple days or three with them trapping beaver. And
probably even ate some of the moose meat.
Oh, we had fresh moose meat that night for supper. Sirloin steak in a Dutch oven.
Yeah, well, that's a good example of what I was going to ask about, is you have examples of things you might have done to help people feel more comfortable and get over those bad feelings. Were there specific things you did to accomplish that?
Yeah, and it wasn't so much I didn't have a plan particularly. I just sort of muddled through, I guess, trying to find ways of not being confrontational and yet and finding out information about what people did and why it was important to them and so on and so forth. So, but as I say, the times are changing. So I think, you know, the perception was fading, but it wasn't gone.
And I think another thing, not exactly associated with it, but besides helping the fellows from Nikolai, to get the guiding license, we also took in home boarding students. So we had 1 year, young woman from Nikolai, and then the second year, we had two from Nikolai. Good grief, what's that walk? I think there's a lynx walking down our driveway.
Oh my goodness.
There's something walking down our driveway. It just went out of sight. There it is. Do you see it?
Yeah, it's
that's
links.
A lynx.
Wow,
you got
how
a
cool.
Lynx walking down the driveway.
It's walking very slowly.
It's a big lynx here.
That's a pretty good size one, too.
Yeah.
Wow, how exciting.
We've been seeing them out here fairly often.
Yeah, I know it's a big lynx year, and I haven't seen one yet, but I'm hoping to. That's cool, though, in your driveway. I had a moose yesterday, but not a lynx.
Anyway,
go ahead, Tom.
I just, you know, listening to Dick's description there about how it took time for people to gain trust with a different agency and being more open to share information about harvest, that still continues today to some degree in rural Alaska. And one thing that I don't remember, Dick, maybe you recall when the Division of Subsistence was founded. I want to say it was in the early 1980s. Most of the reports I know of go to the early 80s. But it was where Department of Fish and Game hired essentially anthropologists to go out and gather more kind of the human dimension of wildlife harvesting for fish, wildlife, and other wild foods and wild resources. And even today in some of the rural areas, they will do household surveys where they attempt to talk to most of the people in the village, and we can actually come up with harvest correction factors from those, because in some proportion of hunters don't always report, and it's common that when they talk with them, they're a little more forthright about what harvest comes on, and so you will come up with a typically a larger number for reported harvest in some of the rural communities. So it's just, that still continues to some degree today. It's gotten a lot better, but I just wanted to make that comment.
And I think it's more common in those type areas, the rural areas, and particularly with native communities, because of the past experience, that it's not unique, because the same sort of thing occurs in urban, suburban, you know, interim, whatever they are, road connected areas, where there's a certain amount of reticence, often in particular neighborhoods, I guess you could say, where people do have a tradition, quote unquote, of indulging in illegal harvest of fish or game, and they're not talking about it. So it's somewhat similar. It's a little different set of circumstances, but it's not completely unique to rural areas.
And so, Dick, then, how did you get involved with wolf control? That was back in Fairbanks?
Now you're really getting into a long story.
That was the idea.
Sort of. I first got involved in it before going to McGrath, and that was as a lab tech grunt. We processed a lot of wolf carcasses or parts of wolf carcasses. There was a real effort at that time by Bob Roush of Fish and Game to collect as much information as possible on wolves. And a source of a lot of that was wolves who were brought in for bounty, most often only part of them, because we didn't often get whole carcasses that way, but we did get some. But to make a long story short, the University of Alaska Museum has one of the largest collections of wolf bones, skulls in particular, probably anywhere in the world, maybe with the possible exception of Russia, if they have collected avidly, and some publications about age structures and so on. So I got a dose of that before going to McGrath, and actually my first trip to McGrath was to process a big pile of frozen wolves out on the river that a hunter had shot there over the course of the winter. But I went too early, and it was like a frozen pyramid of wolf carcasses, which couldn't be separated one from the other. I probably lucked out, because I didn't go back to do that. Another guy drew the short straw, and he had to deal with those after they thawed out. When wolves thaw out, they don't smell good.
No.
They don't smell.
Dick, this brings up a question I had earlier. In the late 60s, where was the lab that Fish and Game had? Was it down in the state courthouse area?
Yes, it was. And boy, did the other state employees object to it.
That's what Dale Hagstrom told me. I think he was hired as a temporary in the late 60s, and he recalls having to do some of those necropsies in there. Sometimes it stunk up the whole building, so the judge had to suspend proceedings, and he would usually send a nasty letter to the Fish and Game supervisor to not do it during certain hours that the court's in session.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. And I've always thought of this incident as the ultimate push to get Fish and Game out of there and over to Creamer's, which by then was becoming a possibility. And that was that one spring we were really interested in the condition of moose after a hard winter, and I don't remember which hard winter it was. There were several close together. So we went out, and I think we took at least one whole cow moose and brought it back and took it apart. Outside, in the parking lot, before God and everybody, blood all over the place, moose guts, you know, all works. And it wasn't, my recollection is, and maybe I'm flavoring this, but it wasn't too long before there was a definite urgency to moving out of there that I think was stimulated by other residents. But that was before McGrath.
So where?
By the time I got back from McGrath, it moved into the facility on Creamer's Field.
So where was the state courthouse building where the Fish and Game Lab was?
Barnett, 6th and Barnett.
It has a university education.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. I know what you're talking about now. Yes. That was before. Yeah. I was trying to think what was before Rabinowitz Courthouse, and so that was it. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now, was the Fish and Game main offices also in that building?
Yes.
Okay.
So and the lab was downstairs, fronting on the parking lot, which was convenient for a lot of things.
In the rear.
In terms of taking specimens in and out. And in that early period, I should mention, also that we collected a lot of lynx carcasses and processed those. And among other things, we took reproductive tracts, both from wolves and from lynx. We took skulls, measurements, and we even took a shot at trying to determine age of lynx by drying the lenses of the eyes, which didn't pan out too well. But it was being tried elsewhere, and so we gave it a shot. Anyway, so McGrath was a good tour. We loved the country, and we made that connection with Minshuna. A lot of good people, and a few people who were not so good. Had to help out the enforcement guy one time when a guy from further downriver on the Yukon came through McGrath drunk and on his way home, jumped in somebody's plane, started it up and ran it into another plane on the ground, and then continued his condition and kind of hid out in town. So Jack Allen, the protection officer, armed himself and went looking for him. And he said, give me a hand. So I armed myself and hoping I wouldn't find him, went looking in the other direction. And eventually he tracked him down to an empty cabin and brought him back. But he really didn't come willingly, so we had a couple of wrestling matches with him before he could get him on an airplane to Anchorage and get him charged and convicted of whatever. But unfortunately, the guy came back through McGrath and he wasn't much better off than he had been when he left. And that was kind of a glimpse into the flaw of the justice system, that here was a guy who was had a real problem, and sending him off to 30 days in Anchorage jail and then just sending him back home wasn't going to do anybody any good. But that's kind of the way it was.
So as area biologist in McGrath, were you commissioned as an enforcement officer as well?
Deputized, yes.
Okay.
And in fact, all the biologists were at that time deputized as whatever, as Fish and Wildlife Protection officers.
Okay.
Did you take training? I think you did.
I took that training later, as I recall. I don't think it, at the time I was in McGrath that I had had training.
So
I think that came later when I came back to Fairbanks.
So they just they just gave you a gun and said, here you're and a badge, and here you're deputized? No training, huh?
Yeah. They didn't give me a gun. They gave me a badge. Said, don't lose it. You're in big trouble. Anyway, the other things that went on with regard to McGrath and wildlife biology was making recommendations on seasons and embankments, doing surveys of big game populations and beaver, and inquiries about other fur bearers in that area. Nothing had been set up at that time when I got there. There had been a conservation officer there who was kind of a preceding me, who was kind of a combination law enforcement and biological technician. And that was a type of position that there were several of early in fishing game's history after statehood that were gradually phased out, replaced with either protection officers or biologists, or in the case of McGrath, one of each.
Do you remember do you remember the name of that conservation officer who was before you?
Yeah, Darwin Skip Braden.
Oh, Skip Braden.
Okay.
He was also a pilot. He was a very competent guy. He went on to other things. He moved to Anchorage, and I think he went to work for an oil company, but I don't know what he was doing. I don't know. I keep thinking I've got to find out if he's still around. I haven't done that. So anyway, I found some areas to survey for moose, and I got a better feeling for where some of the local small caribou herds were, like the Beaver Mountains caribou and the foothills of the Alaska Range and the Big River area, and up in the Tanzona River area, which were a ways out. Oh, I should mention that the other thing that happened prior to my going to McGrath was that bison had been transplanted from Delta Junction to Farewell, which was about 60 or 75 miles southeast of McGrath. They'd been hauled there in cargo planes and released on the Farewell airstrip, which was not regularly used at that time. And they settled in on the South Fork of the Kuskokwim. And for many years, they did prosper to an extent. I don't remember the exact number we transplanted from Delta. It was long, maybe 40 or something like that. The herd grew to about 150, and it just seemed to stabilize there. I think the amount of range was good. Feed range for them was kind of limited, and they trafficked up and down the river where it was wind blowing and they could get to grass and so on. And they didn't seem to be susceptible to much predation for decades. Eventually, after I left, actually, I began to hear that grizzly bears had learned how to catch them, and I don't doubt that wolves did too. Then in sometime in probably the 80s, I can't remember now, there was a big burn north of Farewell Lake. I think it was called the Bear Creek Burn that overlapped the Iditarod Trail. It burned quite a large area, and it came back well in grasses and sedges, and the bison population just took off. It really grew, and grew fast, to up over 200, as I recall. And also by that time, some predation had appeared. Whoever was, excuse me, there at the time found that the bears had gotten some bison. And of course, there have been, for many years now, permit hunts on bison in that area. So they're pretty well established. I don't think there's any danger of them going away.
So that's different than the wood bison that got introduced more recently out by where, Flat or Palikiochuk?
Yeah, the wood bison got put out on the Anoko country near Shagala.
Right.
Yeah, near Shagala.
Okay,
yeah.
So they're different animals.
Yeah, these bison that went to Farewell were from the Delta herd, which were plains bison.
Okay.
And they were transplanted. That was one of the functions the department did, to transplant them to Farewell and to a couple sites in the Copper River drainage. Excuse me. So there's a couple populations down there that don't seem to thrive. Well, that was about it for McGrath.
Okay.
So,
can I ask a question?
Sure.
A couple times you've talked about beaver, and as I understand it, beaver were plentiful when moose were not in this country, you know, many years ago, or in, like in the 30s and 40s.
Oh.
Was there much of a record, or were you aware of beavers being eaten much by the locals?
I don't really know. I don't have records of it, I guess is what I would say. But I have no doubt that they were used regularly, because quite often people were, in those times, that era, people were not in a village, in a community where they had some kind of communication with commercial sources of food. They were scattered out along rivers, like up the Holetna the River and the Holetna River, like Lyme Village, and even Stony River, which was on the mainstream. But so they were pretty much on their own for year-round, basically, but they also had not been really effectively compelled to stay in a major, larger village where there was a school. So they were still pretty scattered out. So I think beaver had to have been a significant part of the diet.
Well, and also in that time period, Mary, as you say, the moose population may have been different, and also the caribou population. There's different time periods where caribou were there or not there, right?
Yeah, that's true. And there wasn't a lot of movement of what caribou there were in the general area from Sleep Mute to, well, really all the way to Tulalip. There were caribou, but there tended to be small bands. A little further east, the McKinley or Denali herd was larger in that period, in that 30s, 40s, even 50s and 60s period, up to an estimated 30,000 at one time. And people at Minchumina, for example, commented that it was, they would often see substantial numbers of caribou crossing the lake during the winter. But in the Sleep Mute area, the caribou didn't get down there much, apparently. And a common practice all along the river in different communities or places where people lived was to make trips by foot to the foothills on foot in the fall and hunt for caribou and moose and sheep. And at that time, there were fewer moose in the lowlands, and so people went where they were, which was a long trip by foot, and often spent a lot of time dried the meat that they got, and in some cases at least made what some people call bull boats, just skin boats made on the spot and floated back down the rivers to their winter sites, hopefully before freeze-up.
Right.
And floating down some of those rivers in a skin boat, you know, whatever description, had to be pretty exciting. And of course, nobody knew how to swim. So if you had an accident, it could be really serious. Anyway.
This question about beaver, it was Sidney Huntington's book, Shadows on the Koyukuk, in 1993, talked about that earlier era of the 20s and 30s of how moose in the middle Yukon were fairly uncommon and caribou in abundance was kind of hit or miss. And so beavers were used very regularly for a food supply. And then in addition, then they got the fur for utilitarian needs like hats and mitts.
Mm-hmm. I should have remembered that.
I was thinking also beaver, if they weren't eating the beaver, they would have used it as bait in trapping and for feeding their dogs. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
The best of dog food.
Uh-huh. No, like I say, I didn't document the use of beaver as food, but I have no doubt that it was used regularly. So anyway, in 1971, the fall of 1971, we moved back to Fairbanks, and I took a different job, which was a research coordinator for the game division in Fairbanks for the interior Arctic region, which at that time included everything north of the Alaska Range, including the Arctic Slope, North Slope, and the western area, Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, etc. And in that position, I was responsible for working with people doing the actual research. I was not involved particularly in any of it, but we had a number of projects going on, mostly on big game species. We didn't have much going on fur bearers, which I regretted. And we did have an active upland game bird program, particularly ptarmigan, that Bob Whedon had led for a while and Jerry McGowan had taken over. So there was a lot going on. And also in that period of time, things were getting pretty hot about predation and wolf control and so on. The other interesting thing in that period of time was that there was some question about how grizzly bears were doing. The population levels didn't seem to be very high, and nobody had done an awful lot of work on them previously, and Harry Reynolds got into that, the south side of the Brooks Range and the north side eventually, and eventually in the Alaska Range. But in retrospect, you know, the general consensus of anecdotal wisdom, I guess you could say, was that grizzly bear numbers were low, and there was no specific well-defined reason for that being the case. And I just was reading something recently that also was anecdotal over the years, and that is that the previous very extensive wolf control program by the federal government prior to statehood, which used poison baits widely across the interior, may have really contributed to the low numbers of grizzlies, because they would eat the poison baits and they would die. Eventually, there was a lot of complaints about that, and that's another story in the wolf story, but after a while, well, the state fairly quickly eliminated the use of poison or any kind of predator control, except for wolves in southeast Alaska, where other methods were ineffective, basically. Anyway, so we had a lot of research projects going on, and I was responsible for working with the people and reviewing those, both with regard to the purpose and the planning for them, the protocol, and making sure they're reported on, and so forth, because we did have reporting requirements on all of those things, as well as on the management activities that were in part, both the research and management were in part funded by the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration, the Pittman-Robertson Act, which really was, Alaska gets a big chunk of that because of its size, and so that was important, and there were reporting requirements to comply with that act, make sure the funding was available. The other thing I got involved with, to some extent during that period of time as research coordinator, wasn't research at all, but in the course of time, Creamer's Fields had been purchased, as we know, and but there was still 11 acres sitting in the middle of it with all the buildings on it. That had various people had various aspirations about it. And I sort of got to be a local contact, I guess, for the negotiations that went on in the state legislature on how to purchase that, and by the state, that is, and make it part of the Creamer's Refuge, rather than leaving it to chance of some other kind of development overtaking that property that would be not necessarily real compatible with the refuge. So that was a really interesting thing too. And the legislature did provide the money to buy that. I don't think it used federal aid money in that case, but the purchase and building, purchase of the Creamer's Fields and the building of the new office space there used PR funds. I don't think the purchase of 11 acres did. I think that was state general funds, which they had too much. They didn't know what to do with at that time, big oil boom.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that the refuge and the buildings were created separately. I know all the battle to get the refuge established to protect that area, I thought it included the buildings right at the beginning. So that's interesting.
Well, that was always kind of a nagging concern because they weren't included. Anyway, that was kind of an interesting sidelight. And then the other thing about it that I lobbied for was to get the administration of Creamer's Refuge transferred from the Habitat Division to the Game Division, because there just wasn't anything being done with the refuge with regard to enhancing the opportunities for public uses. So that I lobbied successfully on that, and Jerry McGowan took over as the refuge manager. Oh, Mary reminds me of a little story. This may be a duplication, but it's a good joke, so maybe I'll do it again. In the course of the legislature trying to decide whether they wanted to put the money out for this purchase of the 11 acres and the buildings, it turns out that the House Finance Committee had lots of money to deal with. And Bob Bettisworth was in the legislature at the time. He is a noted local developer and businessman, a very interesting guy. And he was a guy I had most contact with, because he was really hot to get that land purchased by Fish and Game, the state. And so we spent time together talking about that and other stuff that came up. And he told the story that he was on the House Finance Committee. The chairman was Brian Rogers, and he just couldn't convince Brian Rogers to fork over the money to buy that 11 acres in the midst of Creamer's, even though the money was there. And so he apparently kept pestering and pushing, and eventually, I don't know who else was involved, but they succeeded in getting that done. And I thought it was really kind of neat that here's this guy whose hometown reputation was kind of a hardcore developer, was really kind of the champion for completing the purchase of that land. And he was a hardcore Republican, too. He was also the guy that told me that Tanana salmon, if you catch them around Fairbanks, just weren't fit to eat. I don't know how many times he told me that. Finally, I said, Bob, I got to make a confession. I eat those fish. But he was really interesting, good guy.
In terms of the research that was going on with Fish and Game that you were the coordinator for, how was that research agenda set? Did you decide what research projects should be the focus, or individual biologists made proposals, or the higher-ups in the administration? How did that work?
I think it started with, number one, the interests of the individual investigators, who, for example, if they were interested in a particular species, they would become acquainted with what was known about them and what may be known about concerns for the population or whatever. And usually then there would be a proposal to local staff like myself. And eventually, this wasn't in place early on in the time I was there, but I think probably by the time I had that position, there was a planning committee for the division as a whole called the Program Review Committee, I think is the right term. And so those ideas that sort of made the first base locally, like in Fairbanks, you know, we'd say, well, yeah, it looks like there are things we need to know about the sheep population, and need to prepare a research plan to investigate them. So do that, and we'll take it to this program review committee, which involved mid-level staff from around the state meeting as a group, and it involved headquarters staff as well. So those things would get a review, and if plausible and germane, I suppose you could say, they'd get approval, and then you could fight over the money.
Well, and was the desire to do some of that research based on management issues, like we need to know whether this particular population of moose on the Tanana Flats, how they're doing, or how this caribou herd is doing, because of hunting pressures for management decisions?
That was certainly part of it. And we would have some indications from information about hunter activity, hunter success, evidence of habitat conditions, predation, and weather conditions. We had a stretch of winters in there, and I guess it was a little earlier, the 65 to 72, and maybe a little later. There's several winters that were really severe, and I had not mentioned, but at the time I went to work and started counting moose populations in Central Unit 20 were really very high. Later on, Bill Gassaway back calculated that there was probably over 20,000 moose in Unit 20A, which is almost twice what the desired population is today, I think. So there was a lot of stress on the animals at that time, and it was apparent, and it led to concern about their well-being and the well-being of the habitat, because it was quite a lot of pressure on the browse for the moose. So that would be one example. You know, a lot of times it was kind of an accumulation of not necessarily documented facts, but of observations both by the department people and from the public about, you know, are there a lot of moose? Are there not a lot of moose? Or in the case of grizzly bears, recognition that we heard from the public about very slim bear populations, and a little investigation seemed to confirm that in that early period. So all of those sort of contributed. And then, of course, knowing that the animals in general had gone through some tough winters, you know, the question arose, is it still reasonable to have hunting seasons? And if so, do they need to be more restrictive? Is there a problem? And so on. And of course, in the midst of that came up the question of the appropriateness of hunting cow moose. And that is sort of like wolf control. It's kind of a perennial topic of controversial nature.
Can I just interrupt for a second that whatever Mary is doing in the background
messing up?
Oh, is I'm shifting water from one place to the other.
Okay, well, it's coming up on the recording, and it's going to be problematic if
I will avoid doing
you doing other things in the room. I understand letting the dog out is important, but if you can not do other things in the room.
You can just say that Mary is whitewashing the story.
I thought maybe she was dishwashing, exactly. So, yeah, let's get into the thing about game management and predator control, which is the wolf control issue. And you had mentioned before how in wildlife management, things thinking has changed over time about the effect of predators and those relationships, which I find amazing. That how do people not understand that there's a connection, but whatever, and how that you got involved, and it's kind of a big open-ended question.
Well, I guess
the Kaibab deer—that's where it started.
Make me another note about the situation outside in the Kaibab forest that is kind of a classic of, if you don't have predators, in that case, the deer would overeat the range, and then substantial population declines occurred. And that's kind of been the classic demonstration, I guess, poster condition that's been used for years in wildlife management. the argument's been used both directions, but one of the ways it was used was to indicate that there had to be some limitations on ungulate populations in particular, or they could do that very thing, overgraze the range, whether it was grazers or browsers, and eventually eat themselves sort of out of house and home in the population, instead of kind of going along with modest ups and downs, would have a severe decline. And that was certainly the case, you know, with some of the situations here. We had, with those tough winters, we did have some really serious declines in moose populations in the late 60s, early 70s. And that because there had been, in 28, was the prime example, there had been so many moose. And John Cody came on as a research biologist on moose and looked at browse availability and use in the Tanana Flats pretty carefully, and found that in all the areas that he looked at, and he looked at quite a bit, the browse, everything that was favored by moose was heavily used, willows principally, one kind or another. Not all willows are equal to a moose, but they were browsing just about everything that was available. Then one of the things you would see in times of hard winter was concentrations of moose along rivers, where there would be really good willow stands, and the moose would get into those, and some of them were pretty big, so it would break them down. And I think I still have a picture from McGrath, for example, where along the river and around the airport, where soil had been disturbed, the willows grew very vigorously, and they got pretty big. They got too big to reach the most edible parts, and the moose just went through and broke them off, and it looked like somebody had gone through with an axe and whacked them, broke them down. But it was all a moose effort. They were really desperate. And that was one of the years of deep snow in that area. So, you know, that happens. Anyway, so you see signs like that and you say, okay, what's happening? And how is that going to affect productivity and survival of the upcoming year's calf crop and so on and so forth? And one thing leads to another, and you start investigating these things. And Tom, I think, is now trying to figure out how all those different pieces fit together, if they do. And he's got a monumental task to undertake.
Yeah. Well, and as you've mentioned, you know, there was a wolf bounty back in the 50s and 60s. So wolf control has been going on for a long time in some way, shape, or form. But yes. When did it become the big issue that we think of with aerial wolf control and opposition to that, and when you got involved in it?
First of all, I would just say that bounties were paid by the territory starting in 1915, if I remember, up all the way through statehood, 1959. After statehood, bounties were continued for about 8 years. It was kind of hit or miss. And there were some federal laws that went into place that affected things going on. But I guess I would say that in the 40s and 50s, besides the federal control programs, which were extensive, and I just found a reference to that in a book by Wayne Reglan. The title of the book is Fish Wars, Fish Politics, and Wolf Wars. That's a pretty good history of part of the era of ADF&G that he wound up working in. Anyway, the territory did a lot of control work. He cited a figure of about 25,000 wolves having been taken over the years prior to 1959, plus some number that was unknown of wolves submitted for bounty. So at the time of statehood, I think, personally, I think that substantial wolf control had really contributed to some of the higher moose populations like that in 20A. At the time I started working, moose were conspicuously abundant before those tough winters started hitting. Well, in that same era, the late 40s, following World War II and during the 50s, there were a lot of pilots around. The use of light aircraft was becoming much more common. The good pilots and the good planes like Super Cubs and even others were put to the use of shooting wolves from the air. And the state did issue permits to do that. And as far as I could determine, there was no limit on the number that, in most cases, that the shooters could take, except that there was a board of fish and game rule limiting the take on the North Slope shortly after statehood of only 2 wolves could be taken by aerial shooting. And that apparently was a direct result of the intensive previous federal control by aerial shooting and maybe by poisoning, I'm not sure. And one of the, it's kind of interesting, you know, Alaska's kind of a big village in a way. One of the most prominent predator control people in that North Slope operation was Jay Hammond. He had gone to work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and one of the jobs he was involved in was wolf control. I don't think in the long run he really liked it much, but that's what he did that period of his life. But anyway, I don't know if that answers your question or gets us along or not.
Tom, do you have a question or comment?
Well, I may just have unmuted by accident here. No, I mean, what Dick's describing is exactly what I have been kind of assembling from reading some of the older reports going back in time there. The bounties themselves generally are not that effective because as density of animal goes down, the payment for bounties usually isn't enough to encourage people to really go out and get a lot more. It's the aerial shooting and the poisoning, which really were the effective methods that were used in the 1950s there. And the bounty wolves eventually ended by 1972.
Mm-hmm. But and then yeah. in more recent times, the predator control practices by Fish and Game have been to harvest wolves to get moose and caribou populations to increase?
Yes, in general. And that's driven by a combination of obligations, I guess you could characterize them as, of the state. On the one hand, wildlife is to be managed on the under the sustained yield principle and for the maximum benefit of the people. So on the one hand, you're trying to sustain good populations of wildlife, and on the other hand, you're trying to provide for human uses of those populations. And it can be a tough combination to meet. So you have variations in both the wildlife populations and the opportunities for taking wildlife for human use.
Yeah, I was going to say that, as you've said, those populations have their own natural fluctuations and cycles depending on the weather and depending on their relationships with their predators and their habitat and all that, or, you know, they eat themselves out of house and home. So that natural process is going on, and then the human process is going on. And how do you interconnect those?
Yeah. Well, and the state is obligated to do both. So that's the challenge of the management, is to set regulations in such a way that ensures the sustained yield of wildlife populations. And it's sometimes forgotten, at least by some people, that that obligation applies across the board to not only things like moose and caribou and so on that people like to eat, but also to wolves and grizzly bears and other things that there's not that much interest in either eating or other uses. Some interest, but it's not the same scenario. But still, it's the same obligation that wolf populations, whether they're controlled or not, are supposed to be managed on a sustained yield basis, just like the moose.
And I think that would be a criticism that people had about the wolf control, is that the caribou and moose maybe were seemingly being prioritized over the size and health of the moose population.
Can I bring in a point?
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we're talking about is that in Alaska, we have this advisory committee system, and the people of Alaska have a great deal more to say about wildlife management and fisheries management than they do in many other states. Through the Board of Game system and the advisory committee system. And you get people so passionately promoting their particular viewpoint that this is also has to be blended in, and the Board of Game has to make their decisions based not only on the recommendations of the biologists, but also on what the advisory system and the public has to say.
That's very true. And that makes it a lot tougher than if you're just following a set of data from a study.
Mm-hmm. I think that, for example, in Wisconsin, I'm not positive, but I think that the the Division of Natural Resources or something like that, they make the regulations, and the department makes the regulations, and there's very little, I'm sure there's some, but there's certainly not the kind of public input that there is in Alaska.
Well, that's true. And a lot of states have sometimes often called a commission, which is a separate body from a department that actually makes the regulations based on recommendations from the Department of Fish and Game, whatever it's called, and whatever public input they get. But I don't think any other state has the sprawling public input structure like advisory committees that Alaska has. It's quite different.
Which I think was advocated by the writers of the state constitution.
Yeah, probably.
I can't remember for sure. But the board of games, I think the boards were.
Right. But that relates to my question, which is, when you were with Fish and Game and this, you know, wolf and predator-prey control issue was a hot topic, how would you respond to the concern that the wolves were not being given equal time for how their population was doing, that it was all just caribou and moose? And you just said that the obligation is to try and balance all wildlife populations.
Yeah, but on the principle of the sustained yield principle, which means to be able to sustain populations over indefinitely, mm-hmm. It does, because it's a general statement, it does not necessarily mean maintaining them or attempting to maintain them at the same level at all times. And it also doesn't mean that you have to maintain populations of different species in the same relative level as the next species over. There's a really interesting piece of the discussion of the Constitution from the Natural Resources Committee when the Constitution was being developed, and it relates to a phrase that wound up in the Constitution that I think creates a lot of confusion, because almost no one has stumbled across the background, and I only did by accident. I find a lot of people that haven't, but in the Constitution it says, on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. And the almost automatic response of almost all people is, oh, that means one set of hunters, for example, can have more advantage than another set of hunters. Well, I wound up looking in the minutes of the Natural Resources Committee and at the Constitutional Convention, and there was a very brief explanation or comment that what was really the intent of that phrase was to acknowledge there were times in the course of wildlife management that it would be preferable to manage for the advantage of one species compared to another. And the obvious case in point is for human uses purposes, which the Constitution largely is pointed to, you would manage to ensure that you had a good moose population, even if it required some wolf control or some other condition. So, you know, unlike what I think is sort of a stereotypical response, the preferences among beneficial uses being, oh, okay, subsistence should have a preference to sport hunting, for example. It really was, the discussion really referred to whether you should manage to limit a species like wolves that would diminish the availability of resources preferred by people like the moose or caribou. So it's really an interesting thing. So there's a lot of, I guess you could say, slop in the system. But the bottom line, I don't think it may be very difficult to quantify, but I think the bottom line is that wildlife managers have to ensure that there's no evidence to suggest that a population, a wildlife population or fish population, is in danger of being exterminated or extirpated or done away with. Even, and then the other element that gets into it is that is prone to maybe more unproductive argument is, so you're talking about moose. Are you talking about moose in all of Alaska, or are you talking about moose in 20A, or just what? You know. So, anyway, but the 40-mile herd that you had expressed an interest in is, 40-mile caribou herd is a really interesting case. It's interesting to think of it in terms of what Olaus Murie estimated in 1928 or something like that as crossing the Steese Highway, which was, I think, over 500,000 animals. It was his best estimate. And who knows, probably he didn't even know how close he might be. Just one heck of a lot of caribou were crossing at that time. And I believe that herd is identified with today's 40-mile herd. And that's a little uncertain, I think, because it's so darn big that it could have included all the caribou in central Alaska in one herd at the time. But anyway, since that time, the 40-mile herd has fluctuated in numbers. And as you know, it has diminished considerably 20 years ago, let's say, or thereabouts. And a lot of effort was put into allowing it to increase again, which it has, and part of that involved wolf control. One of the really fascinating, I guess, stories about it is that at the time it was, and there was a special committee developed to work with the Canadians, including Canadians, to try to facilitate the recovery of the 40-mile herd because it was also so important in Western, Northwestern Canada. And I remember really well a remark that Bill Gassaway had. He'd wound up looking at predation on caribou in the 40-mile as part of his research and spent some time working with the Canadians and looking at Canadian country. And he said, you know, that country where the 40-mile herd used to wander when it was 40,000, 50,000 animals or whatever is absolutely barren, not only of caribou, but of almost anything else, because the caribou was such an important resource for everything else that lived there. And when the 40-mile herd was so low, it was just desolate. So that was really, he was really impressed. It was very dramatic. So there's been a lot of efforts to have the 40-mile herd recover, and a lot of the wolf control has gone on there. It I think was going along pretty well in terms of directing that to the recovery of the 40-mile herd until Governor Knowles got in office. Oh, actually, he was preceded by Governor Cooper, who stopped all control programs during his tenure in office, so that was 4 years. And then it got a little bit of a start again, and then when Knowles got in, he didn't want anything to do with it. So he canceled or prevented or forbid or whatever all wolf control, lethal control programs. The department did develop an alternative as a study, management study, I think it was called, of a technique that really hadn't been tried previously, and that was to sterilize the alpha pairs in a number of packs in the caribou herd's calving grounds and remove the less dominant animals to other locations. So it was kind of a new idea. It wasn't lethal control, and somehow it slipped under Tony Knoll's radar, and the department was able to initiate that program. That was about 1994, I think. I got it written down here somewhere.
Was that effective?
Yes. And that's part of the, that gets to the interesting part of the story.
Okay.
The department did succeed in sterilizing the wolves. They did succeed in moving the so-called subdominant wolves, but there was a great deal of skepticism on the part of the public, particularly in Fairbanks and related areas, about whether this would work. And so another program, a private program, was developed called the Caribou Calf Protection Program.
CCPP.
It was funded by private parties in Fairbanks and those that they were able to get to cooperate with them in funding it. And what it amounted to was subsidized trapping under regular trapping regulations, not a department control program, not even a department approved program of any kind. It was simply an effort by an accelerated effort of trapping wolves in the area of in the calving area of the 40-mile caribou herd.
It wasn't called subsidized, it was called incentivized, as I recall.
Could be.
Incentivized trapping.
Call it what you like.
Was there a financial incentive provided?
There was. It was organized so that the trappers, to make it interesting and attractive to trappers, the group that ran it, which was pretty much a bunch of local people here, offered to pay trappers $400 per wolf hide, which was almost twice the going market price at that time. In addition to that, there was a lot of effort putting into facilitating the trappers' efforts by recruiting people either as volunteers or paid, whatever it took, to support those trappers in the field with taking fuel and whatever else was needed out to a location where they could get it and continue their trapping efforts.
And one of the things that, in order to get the 400, the trapper had to have the hide in taxidermy condition, which with the ears turned and the paws, whatever they do anyway.
That was not necessarily done by the trapper. It was done processing of the hide after they got it.
The trapper had to skin it.
Yeah, he had to skin it.
In a taxidermy fashion.
Right.
Well, anyway, that turned out to be pretty successful. And in this area where the sterilization project was underway, I just checked the numbers today, and there were recorded 208 wolves were taken by the trapping effort. And over the course of parts of 2 years, I think it was 95, 96, and 96, 97, something like that. So there was quite a few wolves taken from a large area, but not a humongous area, and certainly related specifically to the calving area of the 40-mile herd. The result was the culmination of the efforts, I guess if you want to call it that, was that the herd rose from, I think it was, let me look here if I can find it, something like 20,000 to 38,000 in the course of the 5 years that the sterilization project was underway.
And the CCPP.
Pardon me?
And the CCPP, which was 2 years.
Yeah, and this, yeah, 95, 96 was the private trapping effort. And the other program, the department's program, ran something like 94 through 2000 or something.
Of course, yeah, it was 97 through 2001 was the sterilization.
Okay.
So they sterilized for four years.
Yeah.
Correct, 4 winters.
No, and the herd, the 40-mile herd now, it's like, what, 80,000, I think? And that the department's trying to get it down to 50,000?
Yeah, I just checked on that, too. And my understanding, just talking to Fish and Game this morning, is that that was the best estimate for 2017.
Okay.
And they're quite sure that the numbers have dropped significantly since then, maybe as much as 20,000 or more.
Yeah, and, I think their goal is 50,000. But my question is, so the herd was in decline, and they did all this predator control, the private trapping, and the sterilization, and all that to get the herd back up. And that was in 2001. So now in 2017, the herd is now super big. Is that because of the success of those control measures?
Well, certainly, and I'm referring to Wayne Reglund's book here, it's pretty clear that Fish and Game felt that combined effort, and he acknowledged the contribution of the trapping effort, which at the time, neither the private parties nor the department were very much willing to concede that the other project was doing a lot of good. There's a certain amount of tension. But anyway, in his book, he says, yeah, it did work, and there was no question but that the trappers' efforts helped it. So it took off. And, you know, it's not an unusual situation. It has done well. You can say that perhaps it's done too well, because it didn't stop, you know, before it is now to some extent a threat to the condition of the range. Another question that I haven't pursued, and I don't know, Tom may have some insight or thoughts about it, but and Karen, you just disappeared, but
no, I'm still here.
There you're back. Anyway, you know, thinking back to the size of that herd of whatever its name was when Mary was on the Steese Highway and estimated that 500,000. What about range extension? Because it is well known that the movements and habits, I guess, and movements, traditional movements of caribou can and do change over time, depending. And one of the things that I'm pretty sure is influences that is the size of the herd. So if you have a growing herd, to what extent does that stimulate movement of that particular herd to new areas that may have additional means of support? And I haven't really discussed that thought with anyone. Haven't pursued it, but it seems like there's evidence that's anecdotal evidence that's happened. And why could it not happen again, for example, with the 40-mile herd?
Yeah, that is an important point. That the planning team that you described brought in a bunch of different stakeholders, including some of the Canadians. And one thing they wanted to see from the a program was that the herd would at some point grow to a large enough number that they might start spending more time back on the Yukon. And to my knowledge, that only really happened one winter. They just never spread that far, and they haven't continued to go back very much to the Yukon. And that's part of the issue of how the herd got so large. It has to do with the intensive management objectives were very broad for it. It was from 50,000 to 100,000 animals, which is a huge range. And there were people that called for more harvest once it crossed the 50,000 threshold, but the harvest plan restricted it, I think, to a 2% yield rate, which is fairly low for a moose or a caribou herd. And so that's been a lot of the controversy, is that some people wanted to take advantage of the harvest many years ago, almost a decade ago, when it crossed that 50,000 threshold. Other people wanted it to get larger in the hopes maybe that it would spread into Yukon. But now it's been so large for so long, there's definite evidence of nutritional limitation now. And there's fear that it could crash if we had a bad winter, which is why there's the push now to do the harvest because of poor nutritional condition. Mm-hmm. And this is really illustrative of what happened, what Dick was describing, of the moose in the Tanana Flats in the 1960s and early 70s, when it was a very large population. They understood that it was nutritionally stressed. And so when you had, at that point, a growing, recovering wolf population combined with severe winters, at the time, the biologists didn't understand the importance of predation as much as we do now. And so their thought was to bring the abundance down through harvest, especially antlerless harvest. And a lot of people, it was very controversial with people, but it just shows that the importance of having a better scientific understanding. And one thing that hasn't come up with that I think was especially important during Dick's career is that in the 1970s, a lot of the staff that he supervised, like Bill Gassaway, who developed modern techniques for assessing moose abundance at the population level with precision, and Bob Stevenson worked with a lot of the old wolf control pilots to understand how you track wolves from the air to count their numbers. There was really a proliferation in the 70s and 80s of scientific understanding and techniques of how you actually assess the abundance of animals at the population level. And that allowed the research to understand predator-prey dynamics much better than with the techniques they had even into the 1960s. So that's an important thing to me, is the development of those techniques to look at this, because when you talk about sustained yield, it's at what we define as the population level. For caribou, it's at the level of the herd, but for moose, we use the game management subunit. So it's not, we don't look at sustainability at the whole state level. We get it down to what we understand as the population level, and that's how most of our monitoring programs now are focused, at that population level for moose at the GMU subunit.
Okay, well, thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Tom. And you know, I had hoped to get around to commenting on some of the work that Gassaway and Rod Borchi et al. Have done on that. And that actually started before Bill, with Cal Lensick, I think, did the first attempt to census moose in the Yukon Flats using a statistical sampling system. And when Bill got into it, Dr. Sam Harbo was great assistance in developing further the scheme for census sampling of moose populations. So there's been a lot of good stuff going on there. And, you know, talking about caribou, I'm just learning recently that the revolution in aerial photographic equipment that the department has now, compared to the old black and white pictures that people sweat over for months to count caribou, has been a real, real blessing in terms of getting more and better numbers on caribou herds when the opportunity to census them comes along.
Isn't another important thing you mentioned was the example of the Kaibab deer down in Arizona, where reductions of wolves, then basically extirpation of wolves, allowed the deer to proliferate to the point of causing starvation because there are many more for their range. Some of the same thing happens when people talked about the extirpation of wolves in much of the lower 48 and how the Yellowstone ecosystem dramatically rearranged some of its dynamics after wolves were reintroduced. the point here in Alaska that a lot of people have missed, they keep pointing to these, but what they lose sight of the fact is that was in a much earlier era before we had understanding of things and we had the tools to assess predator abundance. And it's something we have to explain to people today repeatedly, that not we have a constitutional requirement for sustained yield, even for predators. That's been upheld in the appellate court here in Alaska in 2010. And we have the tools and the ability to scientifically monitor them to ensure that they won't become extirpated. So that's an important thing to remember in Alaska. The only example that I'm aware of where we had an extirpation up here is on the Kenai Peninsula back in the early 20th century. By about 1915, wolves were extirpated. This was well before statehood. And they had, it took them quite a while to naturally spread back on there because the Kenai Peninsula is attached by a narrow isthmus there by the Portage Valley. So there's it's not like there's other areas that they could come into the Kenai. But in the rest of the state, we don't have any evidence that we've ever extirpated wolves or bears. They went down to very low numbers before statehood, but there was enough remote areas that functionally were refugia that those animals repopulated from. And now we use this concept of source and sink dynamics where places like national parks and national wildlife refuges, which in combination are 40% of the land area of the state, those are areas that function as refugia. So even where you have predator control programs that may take out a high percentage of wolves or bears in a small defined area, once you stop that reduction, they have the ability to reproduce at a higher rate because you've increased their prey biomass, and animals, bears and wolves, can immigrate in from adjacent areas where there wasn't control. So that's an important thing that you know, when Dick was active with this stuff, they didn't have the scientific knowledge, they were just starting to gather, but now, thanks to the work that he and a lot of the people he supervised did, we have that case history now that we can illustrate that, and that's what we use to design the more modern intensive management programs so that they're not going to be threatening the predator populations.
We just got some information about this caribou calf protection program this morning, and it included the mission, and one of the goals, the mission of the effort was to bring back more wolves, because and they recognized, you know, we will have more wolves too because there'll be more caribou for them to eat.
Yes, and that's been documented in several cases here in Alaska and elsewhere in the boreal north, that when you have predator control programs that are successful in increasing prey biomass, whether it's moose or caribou, you essentially make more food on the landscape for the predators. So we've seen where both bear and wolf populations have not only rebounded typically within 3 to 5 years of stopping a control program, they actually surpassed that a bit and increased to a higher density than was there at the start of the control program. And eventually that'll come back into a bit more of an equilibrium there. But the reality is when you stop managing the predators to keep their populations at a limit, the natural condition is you go into a low density equilibrium. And that's something that Bill Gasly and his colleagues documented by the early 1990s. And that understanding of that natural condition is what led to the intensive management law. And the statute, the IM statute, directs the Board of Game to take this into account, that when populations drop to a low density, if you get to the point you have to further restrict harvest by people, which is typically a very small percentage of total mortality, then the board is at least required to consider using tools like predator control or habitat enhancement to restore the populations.
And this was when the term predator pit started taking off?
Yes, that's the term that some people use to describe that low density equilibrium. That's the natural state of things. The predators or prey won't go extinct in that, but they basically fluctuate. There's the balance of nature is kind of a poor term because it implies some steady state. And Gasaway and colleagues came up with the term low density equilibrium to show that it'll fluctuate somewhere less than about one moose per square mile. But the only conditions where we've seen where we can apply management to bring it out of that is through reducing predation. And then you can get it something above one per square mile. And if you stop the programs, generally over a matter of a few years, the predators will increase sufficiently to bring the population back down. And the main thing about this is that it reduces the harvestable surplus for people. And this gets to the of a fundamental thing, just to put it in context of what Dick was talking about earlier. We're back in the 1950s and 60s. You know, people in rural area were basically busted for taking cow moose out of season or taking cow moose period. One of the things back then is that it was before electricity and freezers were common, so people didn't have a means to store meat other than drying or salting it. So a lot of times it was common in villages for a person to go out and periodically get an animal and share it among the community members. And so there were people that then were harvesting outside of what was the closed season simply to feed people. And the other context with that is when you have low density and you can only support so many people, what I look at it is the subsistence, federal subsistence system, is you've got a pie that's, if nature produces the pie for you, as when things get to a low density equilibrium, you can only cut the pie up so much, and you have to make the slices smaller and smaller, and some people can't have a piece of pie. Under the state system with intensive management, the statute directs the Board of Game to at least consider, can you bake a larger pie so that more people can have a standard piece of pie? So that's kind of a simplistic example, but it's one I try to give to show what the intent of intensive management is.
That brings up contradiction between federal and state law. Also, there's no imperative in the federal law in ILCA relating to subsistence that has to do with managing to increase the opportunity for subsistence uses, however they might be defined. Whereas with the state legal requirements and obligations to its citizens, the means are there. So in practice, the only system that is providing additional benefits in terms of human uses from wild fish and wildlife resources come under the state system. Nothing is being done in particular under the federal system to better accommodate human needs.
And I think the people in rural Alaska are beginning to realize this. Maybe not.
Well, it's a mixed bag because, you know, the easiest approach is just keep the other guys out. And that's what the Federal Subsistence Board is kind of shifting to. Instead of tinkering with regulatory matters, they're just saying, everybody else stay home.
Well, to me, it's an illustration of how that when people use the term that a management system is science-based, it's really misleading. They can be science-informed, but really what we're getting into is the values of what is appropriate to do on a piece of land. And so within the parks and the refuges, they manage for a lot of different values in there, and there are some people that want to see certain practices not used in there, whether they think that they're not appropriate or they'd want to see just more of nature, a natural system, natural processes. And this comes down to some of the controversy in recent years between what methods of predator harvest are allowed on park and refuge lands versus state and BLM lands. So it really comes down, it's a good illustration of how people have different perceptions or there's different sets of rules for what are deemed to be appropriate techniques or methods used on different land ownerships. And it just shows the challenge in modern times of trying to meet a diverse group of stakeholders for what they want, where in the case of what we're talking about here for game management, there aren't a lot of options for management other than controlling the number of people on there when you're on park and refuge lands. And so they typically don't take active measures to try to increase abundance of the prey species by manipulating predator densities. And I'm not going to say that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's the reality of what those is on those lands. And it described when he chuckled and said that it's complex to do predator prey management. That's the kind of the landscape that we do it within.
Right. And so what you're saying is that on state lands, for instance, the values might be for hunting. And so the management decisions and techniques used put that as the priority.
Well, I mean, hunting is generally allowed on most all the lands. There are exceptions like Denali and Katmai where there's not even federal subsistence hunting. But the difference is on outside of park and refuge lands is that there are many more tools available to manage habitats, manage predator density, manage access by putting in boat launches or trails and things like that that generally aren't allowed under the rules and regulations and kind of guiding principles that were put in place under ANILCA for some of the park and refuge units. And native lands are a third
right.
group of lands that may or may not, because they're essentially private lands, and so they may or may not allow non-shareholders to come in. They may or may not allow predator control.
Isn't there a term that's used in federal statute, natural populations? Is parklands have to be maintained as natural, and there's another term for
viable. I think both of those terms are used in ANILCA, and one, I guess, the connotation is a little tighter for parklands. Naturally diverse or something, I don't remember the exact phrasing. But
there are various terms about diversity, biological integrity, things like, there's several different terms that aren't very clearly defined, and when we've tried to ask for clear definitions, we don't really get them. That makes it difficult because different people interpret them in different ways based on their value system. That's where you get away from science more into the values and how it becomes very, it leaves the realm of science at that point. We can talk about how predator-prey interact, and if you reduce predators, you'll get more prey, but how you actually do that on the land, you leave science, and then you get into the realm of the human dimension.
Well, I think that's really important, Tom, about that, how much the human dimension and our values play into it. It sort of reminds me of what Mary said earlier in one of our interviews about subsistence management, and, you know, it's all unequal. It's just a question of how much inequality you're willing to accept.
It's justifiable.
It's justifiable. You know, it's all values and what one values one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And even the concept of science, where there are a lot of the fundamental understanding of predator-prey dynamics and how to reduce predators sufficiently to allow prey to increase without endangering the persistence of the predators, that was understood during the time frame when Dick worked at Fish and Game. By the early 90s, a lot of the essential stuff had been done with Fish and Game staff and other folks in the Yukon, that we still use those principles today. But there are people that don't necessarily trust what we do, or their values aren't the same as for manipulating systems, and they kind of insist that you have to have a certain level of monitoring or scientific research to do these programs without endangering predators. And our challenge is to try to show them that we can do them without endangering predators, and it would to make every management action a research project simply isn't feasible. This is it's a big deal to me right now in kind of how society and even the scientific community looks at game management, like we do it in Alaska here. We're unusual in that we have such a large area of protected lands with parks and refuges. And it's just hard to explain to people. And that's a lot of my largest challenge, is not only the scientific evaluation of the data, but then explaining it to broad audiences, some that have a real mix of values about whether you should or shouldn't do it. And I need to just stay in the middle and stay out of the values, but they are a huge part of the landscape, and it's important to explain this to a broad audience, not just scientists.
Right.
Yes.
I
keep encouraging Fish and Game and biologists to write opinion pieces in the Daily News Monitor.
Or wherever.
Except I'm not sure that biologists can write opinion pieces legally.
Yeah, if you're a state employee, you might not be able to.
I don't think it's a good idea when you're an active. As a scientist, we have a hard enough time having the general public give trust to what we're saying, and we need to pretty much stay on the straight and narrow on that. I don't want to take over Dick's interview here, but there's a lot of things that he brought up, and Dick and Mary brought up, and Karen's questions over the course of this interview that I'm trying to just bring it back together for kind of where we are right now in the early 21st century. It's just emphasizing that a lot of the important information and understanding came from Dick's era, and we're building on it. But I looked at the real heavy lifting that they did was fundamental to how we can safely do the programs we do today and protect both the predators and the prey, as well as their habitat. Thank Dick for that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Tom. That's why you're joining us, is you can help bring it all together and help explain it, certainly for me, because I don't have all that background. And that's why I wanted to, you know, find out from Dick, yeah, what was going on at the time, and what is this background, and how did we get to where we are today? And I always relate it to the 40-mile herd, because that's a hot topic right now, and I've gotten myself involved in it, and that, you know, how do we how we got to this point. And it's interesting what you said, that a lot of extensive predator control can then later lead to a huge boom in the prey species after the fact, and that makes sense of what's happened with the 40-mile herd. It was in a big decline, there was very intensive management, and now we've had this huge increase that now has to be dealt with, and that it's obvious.
That's a fundamental issue in intensive management is we know how to conduct predator control safely and effectively, but when you have the increase in prey abundance, that's when the work starts, because the basic human nature of not liking competition or more non-local hunters coming into your area to be your competition, that becomes the human issue. And then how do you effectively harvest enough animals to prevent populations from keep growing? That's my perspective on it, from kind of looking at the big picture on it. The predator-prey dynamics is one part of it, but to me it's the easier part. But once you've had, quote, success with it, numerically with the prey animals, then the real challenge in how do the people get in there and effectively harvest enough of those animals. That's, yeah.
Yeah, and that shows the human science management connection. So I just think it's a really good example. That's why I keep bringing it up. So I don't know, Dick, do you have any other comments on all this?
Just a couple, I guess. And one of them is kind of tongue-in-cheek, and that is that people ask me what kinds of wildlife I worked on when I worked at Fish and Game. So I said, well, you know, the moose and so on, and seals for a while. And then I got into the situation where I was responsible for managing the most difficult species of all. What's that, people? You know, it's kind of what you're saying, Tom. And it can be very difficult. And sort of in that light, when I was in college in the 60s, the fad, I'll call it that, was among biologists as well as the public, to some extent, was that predation did not limit prey populations. And some of this work with wild big game prey was done in Canada, and talking with Bill Gassaway after he'd been working on the problem for some of the time, he said, I don't know how they got the results they did, except that I think it was not a normal situation. They really didn't have predation there, that they were measuring it, but it wasn't a normal level of predation. It was really depressed predation. But in the course of the 60s and even the early 70s, gospel in college and wildlife curriculums was that predation did not limit prey populations. And that was, you know, I bought it. I can't remember how many wolf shooters or trappers around Fairbanks. I said, what are you complaining about? The wolves aren't going to limit the moose population. You know, I've had to eat that crow a lot because it turns out that it does happen. And one of the first indications that I had when I got working for Fish and Game, I wound up doing an awful lot of aerial surveys of moose population composition, which was our main tool at that time. We hadn't gotten into censuses at that time. And so you would see bull-cow ratios, cow-calf ratios, percent of calves and population and overall kind of general abundance. And I had gone over moose data from a number of areas, and at that time all the moose data came into my boss, and I looked it over, and I told my boss, and this was in the midst of trying to get rid of the bounty and control programs on wolves, and some of the people, including my boss in Fish and Game, were in the front lines of making that kind of a change, kind of to give wolves a little bit better status in the world. And I said, Bob, you know, this is coincidence. This is not proof, but in looking over this moose data, there's a coincidence. I noticed that in areas where our calf survival of moose is very low compared to the usual, these are the areas where we get a lot of anecdotal information that wolf populations are high. So here's this guy trying to elevate the status of wolves in the public perception by getting rid of the bounty and getting rid of or diminishing control programs right up to his eyeballs in that controversy. And here comes this kid from the back room who says, you know, something doesn't quite match here. It's a coincidence. I can't prove it, but look. And he looked at it, listened to me, and he says, for God's sakes, don't tell the public that. You know, he was stuck. He was between a rock and a hard place, and he didn't want to make it any harder. And then the interesting epilogue to that is, after a period of time, when more evidence accumulated and so on, he became an advocate of wolf control in certain circumstances, because there was no other answer to the leak in the productivity or the population level of some moose populations. There just something was going away that wasn't being recognized. And you know, in some of those cases, still unproven, other cases I think pretty well established, it was the effect of predation. Sometimes in combination with bad winters, which are really lethal, can be, and sometimes not. Anyway, that was very, very instructive.
Well, and that's where I was starting with all of this, that nowadays, the idea that the connection was not seen between the number of predators and their effect on the prey, you know, I can't even fathom. How could you not have known that? It seems so obvious nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, it was based on some research done on those little tiny creatures that swim around in the water.
Well, yeah. Yeah, there was some of that. Lab studies on predation and predator-prey relations. I can't remember the guy's name now. It was really interesting. And he kind of came to the same conclusion, as I recall, that there didn't seem to be an effect of predation on the population level of these microscopic organisms. I don't know what the problem with that was. Maybe there wasn't a problem. Maybe it worked that way in those particular circumstances. Well, but it was a laboratory situation.
You know, as you say, that there are other factors involved, whether, you know, it's the bad winter or, I don't know, competition from other species or whatever. And I understand with, you know, biology, ecology, and all that, how complicated it is with all the variables. And I don't know how you ever figure out if it's one thing or the other.
It's more money than we've got available.
I don't know. And in some cases, I'm not sure that you have to. I don't know that you have to know every answer in order to make an intelligent, rational judgment about what the right management measure is. And I think if it is an intelligent assessment of that situation, then it probably includes some latitude, or as shooters like to say, some windage. So you have a little wiggle room there. I personally believe that it's very, some people advocate managing on like prey species, moose, caribou, things that people want to eat on a maximum sustained yield basis. And I think that's a very dangerous approach to take, because it's not, it seems to me it's not too difficult to slip over the edge in that kind of situation, simply because you don't, you know, you don't know, or you should know, you don't know enough about it to know exactly where you should stop on harvest yield. So you may eliminate your own wiggle room, and the result can be something like comparable, I guess, or you could say parallel to not recognizing the potential effect of heavy predation. You don't really know how far it's going to go before you get a dramatic drop. Or, by the same token, habitat damage. It's kind of interesting, you know. Habitat, I think most people would agree, is the ultimate limiting characteristic for most species, and particularly for plant eaters. But there are so many, maybe not so many, but some really important proximate limiting factors that we've talked about. Weather, predation, even disease in some cases, which in other states, fortunately, we haven't got there yet with ours yet, but disease can be a serious limiting factor. On moose, for example, in places. Anyway, I think you gotta, it's a science, but I think it's reasonable to say it's not an exact science. It involves educated guesses, or good judgment, or however you like to characterize it, and the recognition that you don't have all, you seldom, if ever, have all the right answers. And the other thing I mentioned previously in the interview with Kathy Harms and Scott Brainerd is, beware of fads. You know, the idea that predation didn't limit prey populations became a fad. And to the extent that it simply eliminated thinking it through or looking at the evidence, and it's created a lot of confusion and a lot of problems. And it's the sort of thing that stories like the famous Never Cry Wolf, which turned out to be largely fictional by Farley Mott, nevertheless convinced much of the world that wolves were not serious predators of other big game. And that has survived to this day. It was only about 3 or 4 years ago we were in the vicinity of Yosemite. And we were at an elder hostel class, actually, or trip. And we had a very good naturalist there talking about the natural history of the Yellowstone. And she mentioned various species and said, well, we don't have many rules here. And she, somewhere or another, the issue of Farley Mott's book came up and said, well, of course we know from Farley Mott that they aren't a serious predator on big game. And another guy and I raised our hands and said, whoa, stop, you don't have the whole story. Farley Mott's one-liner was, I never let the facts interfere with telling the truth. Now, how in the world he got to that, I'm not sure, but that was his one-liner in defense of his Never Cry Wolf.
Well, I'm often accused of having data-free opinions, so there you go.
Well, opinions.
From my scientist friends.
And not have any data.
Not being.
I got to tell you one other short one.
Yeah, go ahead.
One time when Never Cry Wolf was hot in the theaters around here, we were in Anchorage. I think it was a game board meeting. And Sidney Huntington was still on the board. And Never Cry Wolf was showing. So we said, Sidney, you want to go to the movie and see the movie Never Cry Wolf? And he said, sure. So we went, Murray and I and Sidney. And he got such a kick out of it. He laughed his way through that whole show. He just thought it was so ridiculous that he couldn't do anything but chuckle about it. He didn't even get mad about it. Usually Sidney, if something saw it was pure BS, he'd get mad about it. But he didn't even get mad about that. He just laughed.
I thought you were going to say he got up and walked out, so that's better that he laughed.
No. We laugh too.
That's good.
Anyway.
Well, this has been great, Dick. We've gone for 2 hours, so I think we should give you a rest here. We had on our agenda a few other topics with the Outdoor Council, and we didn't get to that, which is fine. This was great. It addressed some of the questions I'd had, and so I don't know if we can maybe think about another interview or some other time, or if Tom had any, or Mary had any other things you wanted to say on today's topics. Okay, go ahead, Dick, to start again about what you wanted to say.
I just wanted to make some remarks about the North American model of wildlife conservation, which is a very important model in wildlife conservation in the United States and Canada in particular. So I jotted down just a few notes and I'll read them. The North American model of wildlife conservation is based on the public trust doctrine relating to wild renewable resources. Regarding wildlife, the model expresses the concept that these resources are held in trust for all the people by government unless and until they are taken by lawful means by the people. Such resources do not belong to any landowner or organization or entity such as royalty. The principle of public ownership of wild renewable resources dates back in origin to 1215 at Runnymede in England, when the English barons forced King John to relinquish his claim that taking fish and game was a royal ownership fact. The principle of these resources being a permanent public heritage has carried down through English and U.S. law ever since, and is well explained in the 1989 Alaska Supreme Court McDowell case decision rejecting the rural subsistence priority as unconstitutional under Alaska's state constitution. It's kind of interesting. The model is nowhere, as near as I've been able to tell, in statute or regulation, or even common law, like except in the case that of this example, I guess, in the Alaska Supreme Court, even court decision. Nevertheless, it is the guiding principle in all of the conservation programs, both state and federal, in the U.S., and I believe it's also the case in Canada. The other interesting thing about it is the public trust doctrine, which is equally difficult to nail down and as being an official act of any sort of government, is that the lineage of the public trust that dates back to Runnymede in its interpretation in U.S. law, it runs, the obligation and the authority runs to the states rather than to the federal government, which is really kind of unique. But I think in most people's perceptions, you know, the federal government is the last word in terms of laws relating to fish and wildlife and their uses. And yet, it's pretty clear from the reading I've done that the public trust doctrine says, no, it's the responsibility of the states. And I can't really explain clearly, if at all, why that's the case. But it seems to be. Anyway, it's one of those things that's sort of nebulous, and yet it has had a compelling influence on conservation in this country. So I just thought it might be a good time to tack it on.
Yeah, no, that fits in with what we've been talking about today. So this model, where does it come from? Where do you find that that's written anyplace? Is it in wildlife studies books or what? Or it's the law?
Well, I haven't found it in the law, and I don't know if anyone else has, and I have to admit I haven't explored that end of it as thoroughly as I might, but I do not think, at this point, I don't think it's in statute anywhere.
I'm going to ask Siri.
But I do know that it has been published by the Wildlife Society, which is the professional wildlife biologists organization. Mm-hmm. And I know that it has been also produced, that is, printed and distributed by the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's been printed by other organizations like that, like maybe Boone and Crockett Club and whoever. And Tom may very well know where it shows up and more about what gives it its legitimacy.
Wikipedia's got quite a bit on it.
Okay.
If you get online, Karen, you should be able to Google North American Model Wildlife Conservation. And there are some, like Dick mentioned, the Wildlife Society has put out a specific technical bulletin on it. If you're interested, I could get it to you. But you should be able to locate it online to find the basic concepts behind it.
Yeah, I was just wondering where it originated, you know, where it comes, who wrote it, where it came from, why. You know, it sounds like it's sort of a ethics of professional conduct kind of thing.
Like Dick said, I think it came out of the public trust doctrine that is kind of the foundation for North American wildlife law, especially in the United States.
Okay.
And the public trust doctrine is discussed. There's been at least two editions of a volume, a book called The Public Trust Doctrine, published over the years. And by now, there might be a third one, for all I know. But that's also kind of difficult to track down. There are some good explanations of how it is interpreted and how it is put to use, but I don't remember that there's a really good explanation of how it was legitimized, I guess. Mary's got something here.
It says, although not formally articulated until 2001, the model has its origins in the 19th century conservation movements and near extinction of several species of wildlife, including the American bison, and the rise of sportsmen with the middle class. The sportsmen began to organize and advocate for preservation of wilderness areas and wildlife. And that fits in with the Pittman-Robertson movement of 1937. And all the taxes that go to pay for
Oh, and here's the zinger for this session. 1937, yeah. Pittman-Robertson passed. Aldo Leopold published Wildlife Management. The Wildlife Society was formed. And that's the year I was born.
And me too.
Well, it was meant to be then.
Let's see you top that.
That's perfect way to end it.
I love doing that.
Say, it's fate. You had to become a wildlife biologist. You had no other choice with those connections.
I had no choice.
Okay. Well, now I will officially stop the recording.